Well, that, according to Richard Hedecker, is a stateless society. I think it was probably a different lecture. That's up to you. Anyway, I know you're going to ask questions, but more important to both Richard and I is you're going to give your own opinions. So we're going to split it up into questions or points of view. Everybody, speak and address them to me. Any points of view? You start off shy and at the end you start shouting, don't you? Why is that?
Take some time to get the brain into gear.
Right, so how many forms are there? I know a lot of yard men, but the rest of the things. Maybe a lot of forms F. That for the uninitiated is a form for those leaving the system.
If we could go back to your personal history at the beginning of the talk, did you say that it was a cousin of yours who ran the store in Brighton and had the portrait of Margaret?
It may have been a cousin. I'm not sure what it is. I didn't bother to investigate any further.
So you're not in touch with the outside of the family?
No. No. If you want to give me 101,000 for it, I might act as a go-between. But that's about it, really. They're all shocked and stunned.
Yeah, they are. You're so good.
Oh, Mavis, I'll see you after. The promise fiver. It won't come amiss.
On you go, Cameron.
What you criticised by saying was that really about the state of society, and it's a bit of a problem talking about the absence of something. Unless you get into actually talk about what it's like, the presence of it. And I think that would have been a pity if most of us felt the state figure our colour on occasions, you know, in some way or another. And I don't think there's any doubt about what the existence of the state is. I'm not sure that the legislation for unsocial behaviour has yet been passed, has it? That's the latest little march. And as Steve has pointed out when he spoke, this is really getting very into this desire for control of individuals. And it's almost as though capitalism has reached a particular stepping point where people with power are getting quite nervous because there is a discontent with crime in society, but there's also they're using that as an excuse to in fact put the brakes on people who are not criminals. It's always used as an excuse. But it's marvellous to see what their handgun laws have done, isn't it? Because now there seem to be more shootings than almost there ever were, and now they've got no record of them. They're all criminal guns now, so nobody records. A brilliant piece of thinking that one. But what they did with the gun laws, at each atrocity, like the gun blades, they banned a particular group of firearms and didn't necessarily have anything to do with the ones that were used in the atrocity. This was true of the new group, wonderful, thank you. And it was true of Dunblane again. And there's no doubt about it that the Association of Chief Police Officers had a scenario, they had a time zone, which they marked their steps out and said, they've done this one. They weren't going to try and get the rank of that. And take these steps. So the only ones that legally carrying this one are going to get to be the police. And this is happening on many other fronts. The step by step imposition of curbs on individual limits. People are all aware of this in some sort of way or another, whether they think about it with as much order as the awful politicians do, I don't know. But I think people are aware that society. This is the state. The whole business of bringing back the death penalty, which they've done in America. I shouldn't have given it to them for long before they've got so many in prison that they are going to resort to the death penalty. But it won't be brought in on that sort of basis. It will be brought in because some members of society campaign for it, and they will take death advantage. And they'll have a plebiscite, they'll have a referendum. Yes, they'll get an overwhelming vote for the administration of the death penalty. Now, this is all almost the way in which their movement set forth the Nazis. Oh, that's the state.
Yes, go on.
Richard, if you could say a bit more, you touched on it in the talk about law. This has certainly been something of a hot potato on the discussion forum. It's been a slightly warmed up potato on this discussion. Certainly, I think a lot of people who are members of the Socialist Party would say there would be no role for law in socialism. But I know there are some members, for example, who sees there as being a role for law, not law as it is now, where it's a protective class interest, maybe, but a role for law decided democratically and important.
Well, funny enough, I've got something here I might read out that might be relevant. I just say that I was going to talk about state of society in that other way, something I've done hundreds of times in my life, but I prefer to do this because I got so gripped by what William Morris had to say, and so delighted when I found such a chord. And so, anyway, I'm happy to answer this. You see, the problem is, I was talking about projecting our thoughts using our dreams. Every one of us is going to see a future society in a different way. That's why Morris was so correct to say it was his view of the world and nothing else. We've all got our view of the world. Some may include law. For me, in the kind of society based on the three principles I've just described, this would be inconceivable. Of course, Morris deals with it in his book, in which the perpetrators themselves are much involved with the solution. The problem is that I talked about the use of imagination, the freeing of imagination, and we get trapped when we make projection into what we have now. And this is something a guy called Philip Snowden wrote, which really impressed me. To quote me, the authority of precedence leaves me quite unmoved. All human progress has been made by ignoring precedence. If mankind has continued to be the slave of precedent, we should still be living in the caves and subsisting on shellfish and wild berries. That's more or less my attitude to this thing about law in a socialist society. I refuse to project this crap, this crap system of so-called justice on any basis, even if it's allegedly different, into a society of free human beings. And I pointed out in my talk, it is unfree human beings who commit crimes and do terrible things to each other, not free human beings. Of course, no one can say there wouldn't be problems, but the truth of the matter is we don't know. And as I do not know, I'm not going to do the state's work for them and tell them, well, mate, whatever society you have, you've got to have law. I do not believe it. Do not believe it.
I think that in a future socialist society, well, it's quite obvious that we would have development and change, that it wouldn't be static, far from it. We'd all accept that. And one of the perhaps more obvious things, certainly in the early years, is that there would almost certainly be some hang-ups that people would have from society that we live under today. And so it's not inconceivable that there would be various people acting in anti-social ways, but on a much smaller scale than exists today because of the vast improvements that would have been made. But there would still be perhaps minorities who, for some peculiar reason, might reject the rule of the majority, or might, for some peculiar reason, even want to go back to capitalism. But I think as the years pass...
You're talking about my cousin, aren't you?
Maybe not many more people than that. I think it will become very clear to those people, in a fairly short period of time, that that capitalism has got absolutely nothing to offer the majority of the population. And once socialism has been established, that will have been proved to just about everybody beyond all doubt. But the point that I'm making is that when we talk about any possible laws or regulations in socialist society, I think that there might need to be some type of decisions taken, but certainly in the early stages, on how to treat that small minority of people who've still got some bewildering nostalgia for the madhouse called capitalism, because probably they will have those opinions for a short period of time. But I think as that time passes, the number of people holding those opinions carrying out any type of business opposition, if you like, physical opposition, maybe, so the number of people doing that will diminish to a minuscule amount.
Well, you know, anybody who's spoken for the party in the past will know very well that it's an old perennial. The bloke comes up and said, look, if you have a society like that, mate, there's going to be rape, murder, all this is going on. People to do their neighbours down, they pinch their houses, they'll kill their dogs, you see. And you say, well, will you do that? Oh, no. No, it won't be me, mate. No, oh, no. It won't be me. It'll be the others. Now, there's another point here, perhaps a bit of a nice point, but I want to make it. You see, the longer I live, the more I want to make my projections and live my life upon my own potential. I do not need the law to stop me hurting other human beings. I do not need the law to treat women with equal respect as I treat men. I do not need the law to tell me not to hit my children. I refused to project into the consciousness of other human beings the inability to do something that I can do myself, because they are no different from me in that they share the same gift of consciousness. And I think if we're talking about a society based upon a change of consciousness, then we've got to go for broke. We can't put in the long stop, play the halfway house. We've got to be brave and bold in our imagination. What I was saying about the connection of how you act to how you dream, and that dream of a stateless society with those things in it, which is therefore no need of law, is that part of me that I would never want to get rid of. And I think that enhances all our lives. And I think that's the way we should look at it. Don't say, I can do it, but he can't. But that I can do it, and they can. That's what we should say.
Yes, go on.
The difference between laws and rules. Take, for instance, when I was coming, you go up to the airport in New York, you direct it to a plane, you enter the plane, you sit down, but, you know, the rules are all set out there, what you're supposed to do. They pull the plane out, and he's directed to a certain runway, you take off, and so now there's several things there. The pilot just can't, each one can't go. When they feel like the laws, rules, or whatever have to be obeyed, disciplines have to be enforced somewhere or accepted. Equally, so you come to London, you can't just land in the field, and certain rules can govern. So the society has to have, how do you call it, rules versus laws?
Oh, it's very simple. I think the distinction in my home.
Excuse me, I
sorry.
Made that.
Oh, sorry, did I interrupt you, John? Sorry.
Well,
oh, sorry, John. No, please apologise.
The point is, we freely accept this.
Yes.
I have the point. And I'd submit, if I were a pilot, I'd submit to the man in the control tower, that he said, now you're free to take off. And the same thing, you come to our men, you're going to come in, you approach, and what number would be in line and so on and so forth. But the point is, we accept these things willingly. Yet in some respects, they're wrong.
Well, first of all, your pilot, if he's got any sense, wouldn't actually need the law to tell him not to fly up when he might crash into something else, if he's got any sense. A motorist, if he's got any sense and is driving in England, won't go the opposite way to the other traffic. He doesn't really need a law to tell him that. When I'm bringing up my children, we had a rule in our house that we all respected each other's privacy and we didn't bung into any other person's room. Sometimes, in his enthusiasm, my son used to burst into my room. Luckily, I was always behaving perfectly innocently. But however, when that happened, I didn't need to invoke some law. I simply explained to him, look, do you want me to come in when your mates are there and you might be doing things that would embarrass you? And he said, no, Dad. And you, in a civilized situation, of course there are social norms that you obey. And at the bottom of it all, as I said, the anarchist, any sensible anarchist would have to say, the first principle of a society based on free individuals is that you need to respect the rights of others and consider your action in relation to them. Now, my point is that if that wasn't happening, we wouldn't reach such a society. We would still be back in the society of laws unless that change had taken place. And I don't believe, if this tiny minority is being so difficult, that it would need stringent old style or new style laws to deal with that.
As we seem to have gone on to law and order, how would a social society deal with two hot things that the current organisation can't deal with? The so-called job culture, the lag out, football out, and also the other hot potato, of blood sport. Not only the hunting brigade, the working man's fishing item. Who's the
orchard? Well, I mean, I don't know what to say really, because in the first place, having reached such a society, the kind of problems you describe probably wouldn't resist. I mean, perhaps Dick Donnelly would want to go hunting for his deer. I don't know. I mean, I'm a vegetarian, so it wouldn't concern me. I might hunt a cabbage or two, and I hope that's not outlawed. But these problems, if we were to reach such society, would already have been eradicated. We wouldn't have a job culture. If there was a job culture, such a society would not exist. Now, you may say then it will never exist. That's your right. But you cannot say that in such a society there would be job culture, because there wouldn't.
I think that with this discussion of law, a lot of us have occasionally confused law and custom. Most of our lives are governed by custom. Law is an intrusion. It's only lasted the last two or three centuries. But the rest of our lives have been governed by custom, which is a great deal more powerful than law. The reason I don't go to bed with my daughter or my mother.
Do you want to send her around to me then?
It's nothing to do with the law.
Don't interrupt the question.
It's nothing to do with law, but it's a great deal to do with custom. And if law comes in there, there's something tacky about it. It's an intrusion. It's unnecessary. But I would like to push this argument a little further, that it's not that just that custom encourages us to put up with things, to conform. But let me give you a little scenario. There's a woman looking in a shop window with a little toddler by her side, and there's a sale of something. She's really fixed on this, and this toddler, without her being aware, suddenly turns and starts tottering towards the curb. Now, coming down the street is the biggest asshole that you can imagine. Some really antisocial, somebody who's got nothing for anybody. He sees this. Now, what is he going to do? this kid is about to totter into the path of a bus or a truck. Is he going to dart forward, you stupid little whatever, or just ignore it? No, he's going to... however big a rotten bastard he is, he can't stop himself. Now, I would argue that, there's a war going on in the evolutionary biological world during the past 20, 30 years about how we've arrived in our present situation. That we're the only hominid, man-type ape, that has survived out of 24 or 25. The others have all gone. We've made it. Despite the fact that we're worse equipped than almost any other animal, certainly any other mammal. Our fangs ain't too hot. Our talons are not too bloody good. We can run, but not very fast. We can swim, but we're bait for any shark or crocodile. We can climb, but a chimpanzee half our weight could push us out of a tree. We're still here. Now, this is a matter for biologists, evolutionary biologists, to investigate. But I think in the absence of a better proposition, the reason is because of that kind of behavior, that of solidarity, of sociability. And half of the Darwin wars taking place today are between people who argue there ain't no, we're individuals. That is all that matters. In Thatcher's words, there ain't no such thing as society, and so on. Whereas the others, equally strong, I think getting stronger. No, we're a social animal, and that's how we made it, because the others didn't. And if that is not the reason why we made it, what's your best idea?
Well, I think there's one trump card that the human species has, and that is we are incredibly adaptable. We are able to adapt to all kinds of circumstances in a way which is almost unique in nature, I think.
As individuals?
Not necessarily. Well, sometimes as individuals. We are brilliant at adapting as individuals, but we can adapt as a community. But I must tell you, this thing about the kid in the road, the famous debate I had with a speaker from Animal Liberation. And I put a similar question. I said, because he was claiming that animals all had the same rights as humans. And I said to her, if your son and your cat ran into the road, what would you do? She said, I would have to think very carefully about it. I mean, unbelievable, you know, but of course you're right. If we see somebody in trouble, it's our instinct, you know, to do it. But, you know, what you say, I think...
I never like the word instinct, by the way.
Exactly.
Okay, question.
I just back from Guatemala and I spent a few weeks there traveling there.
Where's that? Guatemala?
Guatemala, Central.
Been there.
Yeah,
man, been there. Got a T-shirt. How was it? Guatemala.
Don't interrupt the speaker, please.
I stayed with the Spanish people. They all informed me that the crime is non-existent in these places. Violence is non-existent. They're not law courts, they're not police. The questions are the land rights, the questions of the water rights and things like that. They were settled by normal elders in the villages. And the members of the community accepted something. They got about their lives. So in a microcosm, here we have another example, even if you happen to find property or land, people still have got together in certain circumstances. They could resolve their problems right now without having to find out the cause to the state, you know. So even the capitalists, it's still just now, it's only socialism. We grew up in the courts.
One of the things that I didn't mention in my talk, because it wasn't really in my... spectrum, although Donnelly thinks none of it was in my spectrum.
None of
but
it
was
subject.
Well, obviously you didn't hear a word I said, Donnelly. It's a shame really, but never mind, I'll still give you a whiskey. But when I was reading this, I was very moved by something Morris repeatedly said, that he deeply believed that all human beings had a desire for beauty and a deep need to create. And everybody, he said, could do it. Everybody could do it. Now, when I used to run an art shop, there was people used to come in who used to tell me they couldn't draw. And I used to sell them this book. I'd like to have given it to them, but I had to sell it. I would have got the sack. The drawing on the right-hand side of the brain. And they used to come back, it's amazing, I can do it. Now, when I read this in Morris, I thought, well, I've always liked to believe that. But, you know, then I went back to work last Wednesday. When I went in there, I was hoping something like... I found this from one of my firms I used to get supplied by, a big art firm called Winsor & Newton. And they ran this worldwide painting competition. And it was won by this guy who lived in the Amazon jungle. And this woman had somehow met him and took him paints. And he'd done it for 5 years. And oh, you can have a look at this painting. I tell you, you know the paintings of Rousseau. Well, this painting is absolutely stunning. And he'd never had a lesson. He'd just done it himself, if you want to have a look. And, you know, we mustn't ever forget what human beings are capable of. And that's what, you know, I think happens when we try to project law as the present society in whatever form into a future society. We don't need to do it apart from anything else.
I think one of the reasons that some people bring this question of law and order, and I know the measures that have been hinted at, who do this, are concerned about the fact that, in one sense, one day it'll be a capitalist society, the next day legislation, in the different existing states, the next day legislation will be passed where it is no longer a capitalist society. And they are thinking, but these are the same people, conditioned in the same sort of way as everybody else has been within capitalism. It's a very simplistic idea of one type of revolution, and it's an absolute impossibility. And to revert to something I've already said once today, one of the things which is most notable about, say, the French Revolution, but also the English Civil War, which is a revolution, was the euphoria. In the case of the English Revolution, it was ostensibly religious. It was a Puritan revolution. But in fact, they were full of it, and they had already worked out their ideas of what they wanted their new society to be. There were differences amongst them, of course, and it was a failed revolution. It was the French Revolution also, overturned by the rise of capitalist class. The French Revolution, again, this tremendous surge of euphoria, but also what it seems to have done in most cases, brought out an orderliness in the way in which the revolutionaries behave towards one another, the way in which they organise themselves. Now, this is, I think you used the term, change of consciousness, and I think this is an essential concept when we talk about the actual revolutionary process, that it's a shift of gear. And if we try to imagine revolution without it, we try to think that it is simply a cold, calculated decision, and we're being extremely rational about all this and being scientific. I think the point is that the rationalism and the science come after or on top of the euphoria, the emotion. They are the working out, as Morris worked out, what he desired. He went into it rationally afterwards, but the family was his thing. And that ought to speak as well. And so to have the same sort of behaviour for Yom Kippur, for example, in the early days, which is what they're worried about. They're worried about the early days, the carryover of people's behaviour. But the early days, saying the euphoria, which has changed people's consciousness.
Well, you know, a chairman shouldn't speak in that. I don't intend to speak in this sense, other than to say that certain party members have spoken in this, and it must seem strange to people that are not party members. So I'd really like to hear from a non-party member on this subject, the stateless society. Would them be like to give us a view or a question, something of that nature? There seems to be a kind of comfortable thing here, you know.
Yeah.
Party members all scratching one another's backs, which I hate. You know, has them got something to say? Right, okay, we'll keep on scratching each other's back. You don't actually believe this, do you? That we're going to have socialism and we're going to have no problems. Everything's going to be lovely. That's what we've been told today. You've all agreed. Come on. Right, thank you, Cumbie. Cumbie Duke.
You're not getting laws in a socialist society. That's almost... what is a law but a social rule or a social regulation made and enforced by the state? So there's going to be no state in a socialist society because there's going to be no law. But I don't think it follows from that. There's going to be no rules and regulations, no permanent standing rules and regulations. Even after socialism has been established for a long time, in the second generation, if you like, for instance, Catholic regulation. You were quoting from the news from nowhere they're having a debate and supposing they've decided in local council what is going to be the speed limit for driving down this road. Is it going to be 40 miles an hour or 30 miles an hour? So supposing the people, the decision is 30 miles an hour. Obviously, people who are in favour of 40 miles an hour will accept that decision and they're not going to drive down that road at 40 miles an hour. But you could imagine a situation where somebody, under some circumstances, might break that regulation. They might be in a hurry, they might be drinking or something like that. Now, what do you do under that situation? Do you just say, don't do it again? You might do that for the first time. But at a certain stage, you might say, right, we're going to not allow you. Right, we're going to take away your driving license. The next time you go to the carpool at the end of your road to use a car, they won't let you have it. Now, if you're going to take that right away from somebody, you have to give him or her the right to argue their case for not having my license taken away from them. You know, so I can't see that. You will have to have permanent rules and regulations. Two, you're going to have some sort of machinery for deciding if somebody has infringed one of these rules and regulations, and that somebody's going to be given the right to defend themselves, and you've got to have to decide what to do in that event. I don't think it can all be settled on a friendly basis. Not criminal law and that. Social society. People can do other fields, and people have argued that